This hour of the Jason Rand Show is brought to you by You Build It. There is a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
So Washington students in 10 districts all across the state of Washington now go to a school with high-tech security with cameras that end up getting shared with the local law enforcement. This is really an issue that's out of Spokane County, but it's an issue that I hope spreads to the rest of Washington state. It is a tremendous idea, especially because the ACLU doesn't like it. The cameras are used in emergency situations. The kinds of situations that we pray to God that it doesn't actually happen, but we know it's a possibility. It's a slim possibility, but it's a possibility. Let's say there's a school shooting. Well, now, at these 10 school districts, deputies on their way to interact with the shooter has someone back in their offices saying, okay, we spotted the shooter. The shooter's wearing this. The shooter's in this part of the school. There are victims on this side. Like, they can actually coordinate that better. Randy Russell is the Freeman School District Superintendent. He spoke with Cairo 7 TV and said, this is being done solely with safety in mind. This is a school that 2 years ago had a shooting on campus that left one student dead.
We know that kids, when they feel safe, they learn better. It's a better environment. And so I don't think there's any student that wants to go to an unsafe school. The agreement allows Spokane County Sheriff's Department to have real-time access to their surveillance equipment to be able to assist in dealing with whatever kind of an incident you might have.
But of course, the ACLU of Washington is outraged because they think it's going to be abused. But by the way, as they complain about this, did the community complain about this?
Not one bit. When you've been through a situation like we have, it certainly changes your perspective on things. And I would just encourage people to keep an open mind. I think it's beneficial for all the kids.
And all you have to do is talk directly to the law enforcement agencies that would be involved, including the Spokane County Sheriff's Department. Now, Ozzy Knezovich, the sheriff there, was on this show about a month ago to talk about this. And now it's a point that he made that's being sort of underscored by the undersheriff, Dave Ellis.
You know, what they're going to be able to do is they're going to be hopefully identify how many suspects there are, what those suspects are wearing, where they're located at, and then also if we have any victims that need medical attention. The sheriff's office respects privacy of students and staff, and that this is a tool used purely to enhance the safety of those students,
exactly,
those staff, and our first responders.
I back this idea 100%. Kendrick Washington does not. Kendrick is the youth policy counsel for the ACLU in Seattle. He loathes this idea. He says, in part, according to Cairo 7 TV, perhaps the most important question is, what constitutes an emergency? I can tell you what constitutes an emergency, and I trust law enforcement officials to understand what constitutes an emergency. I believe that they're going to be able to tell the difference. I don't believe that a school is going to say, oh, we've got an emergency situation here, and then the 911 operator saying, what's going on? A student is refusing to eat his lunch. I don't think they're going to look into that. He goes on to say, is this actually an effective tool? There really isn't much out there that shows adding more cameras into schools makes kids safer. Oh, so you're worried about their safety. Is that what that is? You know what this makes? It makes it easier for law enforcement to do their job. This isn't necessarily just about keeping kids safe, although I would argue that if you've got cameras set up where people know that they're being set up and that they know that it's going to potentially give access to law enforcement, that might have an effect on making people act a little bit better. But here's what I know. I know that if, God forbid, there was a school shooting on any campus there, someone in the sheriff's department is able to look up information to relay to the deputies on their way there. That's going to make it safer for everybody. Because the longer that law enforcement does not have any interaction with that shooter is that much longer that shooter can injure a student or a staff member or another officer who might end up walking into a trap. So I think it's actually safer. Now, another concern that they voiced was that the cameras are going to be used to turn the school into a police state. That's going to turn this into criminal justice issues unnecessarily. He's quoted as saying, again, Kendrick Washington, the more you involve police in schools, the bigger the opportunity is to criminalize a child's behavior. These are the types of people who don't like cops, that always view cops in the negative. I say when you have an officer that's friendly and helpful and is a resource on a campus, it doesn't turn this into bigger opportunities to criminalize behavior. It turns it into better opportunities to create a better relationship between the public and the police, something that I don't think Kedrick Washington likes, because he believes, it seems, that police, when given the opportunity to abuse power, will abuse power. That's a sad place to be, and I am so glad that Spokane County decided to tell people like Kedrick Washington, why don't you mind your own business and focus on your own stuff? You have no influence here. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? You can't make this up.
So over in West Seattle, a business was at the center of what's being described as a bizarre attack, mostly because it's a random act of vandalism where some dude was throwing a whole bunch of rocks at the window of Whiskey West. But they actually thought, because of the noise it was making and the small holes it was creating, people there were thinking that there were gunshots of some kind. Here is the bartender, Annalisa, talking with Q13.
My immediate thought was that it was a gun because it just the pop. I just started screaming, everybody get down, and duck down behind the bar. One lady ran so fast, she got stuck in the little nook area and had to jump the banister and sustained some injuries to her ankle.
So the suspect in this case is in his early 20s, and he was seen throwing rocks through the window front. Owner Colin Pickering said, this is kind of weird to happen in our little neighborhood bar.
Well, this guy had a vengeance going on. He was going for it. Well, you don't expect it in a neighborhood bar, you know? Yeah, we put up with downtown. It's cost of doing the job downtown, but not in a nice neighborhood like West Seattle, you know?
This really spoke to me, because I'm thinking you're picking up on the exact same language that I did. This doesn't happen to us. It happens in downtown Seattle. I get that it happens there, but it wouldn't happen in this nice little neighborhood of West Seattle. This is the reality of living in Seattle now. The issues that used to be very specific to downtown and maybe Capitol Hill are starting to spread. And it's not just spreading to West Seattle or Northgate or Lake City or Eastlake and South Lake Union. It's spreading to Bellevue. It's spreading to Everett. It's spreading to Snohomish and Tacoma and Olympia and Spanaway and Sultan. This kind of stuff has the tendency to spread. If you think you can escape it, think again, because bad guys see what's going on. And this isn't necessarily just about being a bad guy. My sense is, based on the details here, is he's someone dealing with mental illness. That's my guess. Now, if that's the case, understand that there's no plan in Seattle to address this adequately. This guy got arrested. They caught him. But let's be clear, he's going to be back out on the street. He'll be back out on the street in a couple weeks, and I guarantee you he's going to do the exact same thing again and again and again. It may not be at Whiskey West, but it's going to be at another bar or another cafe or another coffee shop or another business, because that's what's happening in Seattle. Prolific offenders being driven by a lack of law enforcement, a lack of sort of political will, is being allowed to continue to do this over and over and over again. And we're all suckers if we think just because you live in West Seattle in a neighborhood that generally doesn't see this sort of stuff, that you're immune to it. You're not immune to it. There is no one immune to this kind of nonsense all across the Seattle area. There is not a single person, there's not a single community that's not directly going to be impacted by this. Especially in King County, where we have Dan Satterberg, a prosecutor who won't do his job, a city attorney in Seattle and Pete Holmes, who refuses to do his job. They don't want to put these people in jail, nor do they want to compel them to actually get the mental health treatment that I'm assuming they need. And then on top of that, what's another issue that's facing at least the Seattle area? The SPD is understaffed. Last year, we broke the story that there was a mass exodus of cops. And we were told at the time by folks over at The Stranger, by King 5, Jason's making it up. There's no proof. No proof, not happening. And then about 3 months later, the Seattle Police Department comes out and says, we've got an issue. And then 6 months later, the Seattle mayor says, we've got an issue. And then all of a sudden, my reporting from a year ago is backed up. No apology, by the way, from The Stranger or King 5. No, like, oops, our bad. Q13 said, no, Jason had it. Brandy Cruz said, Jason had this a while ago. That's a problem. We don't have enough cops to police these neighborhoods. And we don't have enough presence of officers, and especially when the bad guys know that, they're more willing to act out, and unfortunately, it also means they're likely to get away with it. Now, in this case, again, thankfully, They caught this guy, but unfortunately, he's going to be out doing the exact same thing. I near guarantee it. In fact, write this down. Jason Tells the Future. Put it in the Future Predictions book. The one, no, the pink one. No, that's not pink. That's not pink. The other, no, I know that. Okay, thank you. Why is it so hard? Being that's your, fuchsia.
Being your producer is one of the worst things I could think of in the world.
Well, you know what? You're only 2 weeks in, Peyton. So put on that seatbelt, man. I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to gender it. Put on that seatbelt, earthling.
Thank you.
1-800-465-8770. Send me a text on the NumBetter Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. If you haven't already done so, give me a follow on Facebook, facebook.com/JasonRantsShow. Give me a follow, go behind the scenes of the show, participate in conversations. We've got a poll going on right now as to whether or not we should have a live remote broadcast in Bellevue in the middle of October. We're looking at a Friday starting at 3 o'clock. You can watch us do the show. But I want to know if you guys are even going to show up, because I don't want to do it if no one's going to show up. Then it's going to be looking really bad for me. So why don't you go vote in the poll? It's up right now at the Facebook page. Just a few posts down. Facebook.com/JasonRantsShow. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Your health.
So a judge in Florida just ruled that parents don't get to keep custody of their 4-year-old kid. Now, you might think that that is a step too far unless there's some kind of abuse going on, and there is abuse. It's not traditional abuse. This is abuse of a kid that is dealing with leukemia. And rather than give him the mainstream medical treatment that he needs, which includes chemotherapy, his parents are trying to find natural cancer treatments, of which they do not actually are able to find. I wonder, by the way, who these people are going to vote for.
Dark psychic force, yeah, of the collectivized hatred.
Sounds like a Marianne Williamson deal. Noah McAdams was removed from his parents' custody back in April. This happened after they skipped a chemotherapy session. They went to Ohio to pursue alternative treatment methods. Judge Thomas Palermo said it's gotten so bad with this family that the mom removed an intravenous catheter from her son's arm without medical permission.
Ms. Blandball testified that she had no training on how to remove a PICC line, had not researched the ramifications of removing it, but was aware that the line could break off in Noah McAdams' body. She explained during the trial that she was still comfortable removing it because she had watched a YouTube video on how to do it. Wow. She also explained she had inserted IVs into adults, and she knew that there were two hospitals located approximately 10 miles away from the cabin if there were any complications. And with that, and with Mr. McAdams' consent, she simply pulled the PICC line out of her son's body.
I know that they don't do this. These parents aren't doing this because they hate their kid. They're doing this, in fact, because they really, really love their kid. But their love is going to kill him. This kid is already dealing with leukemia. That's not easy to overcome. He can't overcome it. Unfortunately, the parents are choosing not to give him the medical treatment that's necessary to overcome it. If you're an adult that wants to gamble on your own health with some of these crazy solutions, I put in air quotes, okay. If that's what you want to do as an adult and you are otherwise of sound mind, go ahead and do it, I suppose. I don't recommend it, but if that's what you want to do, okay, fine. Don't do that with a 4-year-old kid, because that 4-year-old kid doesn't get a say in this. That 4-year-old kid, if you present it in a certain way, hey, would you like something that's going to be tough to go through but will definitely help? Or, oh, would you like just a massage? Maybe we'll give you some hemp oil, and then all of a sudden your cancer will go away and you won't feel anything. They'll probably go for that avenue. They shouldn't. This is a kid whose life is on the line, and while I totally acknowledge that the parents care deeply about Noah, I would prefer the kid taken out of their custody until he can be cured of this disease, until he can be treated effectively of this deadly disease. So I wish the best luck to this kid. And again, the parents aren't necessarily the bad guys here. They're not reasonable. I'll put it that way. I was going to just be mean. I'm just saying they're not reasonable. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in Trumplandia?
So we talked about it in the first hour of the show, and Ben Shapiro had stopped by. President Donald Trump abruptly announced this morning in a tweet that he has asked National Security Advisor John Bolton to resign. In other words, he fired him, noting that he strongly disagreed with a lot of Bolton's suggestions, quote, as did others in the administration. Now, the president specifically didn't talk about what that meant, but the Secretary of State did. Mike Pompeo told reporters today that he had a lot of disagreements with Bolton.
Rights to do so. I don't talk about the inner workings of how this all goes. We all give our candid opinions. There were many times Ambassador Bolton and I disagreed. That's to be sure. But that's true for lots of people with whom I interact. My mission set is always to make sure, as I run the Department of State, is to deliver America's diplomacy and to work with the team, whether it's the Treasury or the President's staff, to make sure we get good outcomes. I know everyone's talked about this for an awfully long time. There were definitely places that Ambassador and I, Bolton and I, had different views about how we should proceed.
So there's some disagreement as to how this all went down. John Bolton said that he actually offered his resignation, and then after he offered it this morning again, Trump then claims to have fired him. So my assumption is actually that John Bolton is telling the truth here just based on how the president has handled these things in the past. But I will say it's a little ironic because part of the tensions apparently had to do with the fact that John Bolton was seen as someone who was leaking a lot of information to the press. And so as this was going down, he was literally texting reporters as they were on air live telling them, no, this is what really happened. So a little bit of irony there, even though I understand why someone might want to do something like this. But then, of course, the reason, okay, what is this really about? Here's my guess. The Camp David meeting with the Taliban, which was a horrible idea from the president. This was an awful idea. Awful idea to invite the Taliban to come on 9/11 to Camp David for talks. Horrible, horrible, horrible optics. Apparently, the president was a fan of it. John Bolton was not. I'm assuming that had a lot to do with it because you know what? What ended up happening was, because this stuff was put out there and perceived so poorly, the president needed someone to blame. The president, we know, watches a lot of TV. He watches a ton of cable news. He listens to a lot of people, including Tucker Carlson, which, by the way, who's been on Tucker Carlson now 5 times and also has an IMDb profile to say so. This guy right here. So maybe the president listened to me or will listen to me in the future, so I'm okay with that. But he doesn't like the fact that people call out his stuff. They don't like the fact, including on Fox News, people calling him out. He needed someone to blame. He decided to blame John Bolton. Beyond that, I guess John Bolton, who is known as being particularly hawkish on these types of issues, apparently was taking too hard line of approach with Iran and North Korea. If you are a businessman looking to make a deal, which is everything that Donald Trump represents, he's always willing to overlook some things to try to come to the table and get an agreement. And there's some validity to that approach, right? There's some legitimacy to that approach, I should say. I don't necessarily love it. And if you are going to take that position that you're looking for a deal, anything to get the deal done, I do want someone who's a hardliner there. Just to reel you in a little bit, or at least to present to you the other side. So you're not so quick to get that deal that you end up ignoring a whole bunch of important and very, very, very dangerous lines that you might be saying, it's not that big of a deal. Especially when we're dealing with Iran and North Korea. Now, here's the deal. This wasn't specifically even about that, I don't think. When John Bolton goes on TV or does interviews, he had the tendency to disagree with the president, even if it was just very subtle. Presidents don't like that. This is not a Donald Trump issue in that regard. Maybe he has a little thinner skin when it comes to this, but he should. You're supposed to be a united front. The president is in charge. You, as a national security advisor, you are there to present your advice. Sometimes it will be taken. Other times it will not be taken. So if it's not going to be taken, you have to be okay with that. Because ultimately, you're not in a position that's elected. The president is. And if you can't keep that to yourself, then you don't belong in any administration. This would happen under Obama or Bush or Reagan or Clinton. Like, this would happen. If you can't keep your disagreements private, then you have no role being in that White House. That's a position that I hold. That's a reasonable position in my view. There are people who work for the president who disagree with him on a lot of things. One of those people is, for example, Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo disagrees. You know what he doesn't do? Go on TV and talk about those disagreements or highlight those disagreements. He never does that. He is a team player. He He's a part of this administration. And that's why he's lasting as long as he is. If you can't get on board, then sorry, you're out. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text on the Numb Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Councilmember Abel Pacheco of Seattle introduced legislation to fast-track city projects they believe to be of paramount importance. It would speed up environmental reviews, essentially. Councilmember Pacheco joins me live to discuss. Councilmember, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So you said that the process, as it is right now, has essentially been used to delay projects. So how has that happened under the current system, the current rules, and how would your legislation change things?
Well, the legislation that I sponsored was in response to House Bill 1923 that the state legislature passed this year, which gave cities an opportunity to modify their CEPA process, which is the State Environmental Policy Act, which analyzes the environmental impacts associated to decisions that we make around housing or some of the infrastructure needs around the city. What we had seen and we had experienced over the last few years, whether that's through MHA, issues with the Burke-Gilman, Fort Lawton, or with the accessory dwelling unit, backyard cottage legislation, was that there were delays made, brought forth intentionally to delay legislation, which ultimately the city chose to do. And, you know, some residents used the process, which was meant to protect the environment, to delay projects that really, quite frankly, our city needs to be implementing in terms of addressing our affordable housing crisis.
Can you give us an example?
So
can you just real quick?
We saw that the tool was being weaponized, and the state had given us the opportunity to make some modifications, and so given us 2 years, and so we as a city decided to move forward to raise our thresholds.
Can you give an example of the ways it's been weaponized in the past? Because my assumption is the people who engage in this kind of thing might not see it that way. They might say, hey, you know what, we are engaging the way that we're supposed to.
Well, you know, I'll give you the example of the Bullet Center, and this was used during the public hearing yesterday. The Bullet Center, which is, you know, the world's cleanest and greenest commercial building, being delayed for parking, because of the impact on parking. And so that was an example where a project that was a green building, you know, something that it's a point of pride for the Pacific Northwest, was delayed for SEPA, and that's where example where SEPA is used is weaponized to delay a project. We saw the same thing happen with the accessory dwelling unit legislation that we took on earlier this summer. We had delays for about 3.5 years in the city, and broad consensus all throughout the city that yes, we want to support making it easier to build a backyard cottage or a mother-in-law unit, and it was delayed through SEPA.
So if you acknowledge then that there are ways to unnecessarily slow down these projects as it relates to city projects, shouldn't then this be expanded to developers that aren't necessarily working specifically on a city-endorsed project like the Burke-Gilman Trail or Fort Lawton, where they're bringing in new housing units?
Well, this provides a lot more clarity to the appeals process. So by defining within a set period of time frame of when an appeal has to be heard, as well as when the decision has to be decided upon, we're giving a lot more clarity to that process, so that delays on projects or delays on housing projects or projects around our infrastructure needs aren't delayed for the 3 years, 3.5
sure.
years. Now there's a definitive timeline of 120 days, and if mutually agreed upon by both parties, an additional 30 days, so that there's a conclusion. A conclusion and resolution to the process.
But I don't think that answers my questions. Let me phrase it a little bit differently. Is the process that you would endorse with the sponsored legislation, would it impact private developers the same way it would impact developers working with you guys on city projects?
It would impact both parties. Correct.
Okay, so everyone is treated exactly the same, which I think is a big part of why there was some controversy, I suppose, as you first developed this, which is it wasn't necessarily pitched that way. And I think whenever we're talking about stories like this, legislation like this, it gets a little wonky. And so people are probably a little bit confused. The one thing that throws me a little bit is something that you think is a good thing. And on paper, I get it. You know, when people are trying to get involved in these things and they make it unnecessarily long to drag out the process, it's a problem. But one of the benefits of that is the longer that the process takes, the more input you might receive from the community. And I can see why sometimes cities might not want that when they're doing things, projects that might be deemed controversial.
Well, I think we all acknowledge that we're in the midst of a housing crisis. And so we're still going to go, projects will still go through the process, but the appeals in by which the measures that some residents had employed to delay projects, we're really beginning to restrict that and find new ways to find more definitive timelines to when those decisions have to be made around projects. And I mean, I think this is probably where your listeners and I find a consensus on, which is, you know, we're just cutting through some of the red tape through the bureaucratic process that sometimes people use to delay a project. And so we're hoping to be able to streamline that process in a way that's most impactful for the growth that's happening in our city.
Councilmember Abel Pacheco joining us live this afternoon. It's kind of funny because I know that this is not specifically an issue that you cause, but as you're saying, we need to get in the way of people who are trying to needlessly make these kinds of projects a hassle, going on long and long and longer than they need to. Didn't the council just do this with the Save the Showbox movement? Didn't they essentially do the same thing? They didn't use SEPA, but they used a way to stop something from happening, and they're needlessly dragging it on to stop a project that has every right to continue.
Well, I differed a little bit, but
you did. You were not on that side. For everybody, just to be clear, he was not. Abel Pacheco was not a council member who tried to move with the Sawan argument here. So in this, you're not the bad guy here. But isn't that essentially what the council did?
What the council's actions did prior to my arrival is something that I just don't even want to engage in, because it's I'm trying to focus on what I can make a difference on in the matter short time that I have here on the council.
Fair enough. Now, your colleague, since we mentioned Chama Sawan just briefly, she talked about legislation that she'd like to introduce that's, I think, related in a way to this. She wants to make it easier to build up to 40 tiny home villages and transitional encampments in the city of Seattle with much fewer limitations on the zoning as to it. Do you support that move?
I haven't seen the ordinance, so before I can comment on it, I'd want to see it and read it in detail. I mean, I try to do my best to read the different ordinances that come before me and try it so that if I can provide input or guidance, that I can use the amendment process to provide some guidance. So,
do you think tiny home villages, the way that they've been used right now, has been effective in addressing some of the root causes of homelessness?
Well, I think it's one of the many strategies that we should be employing as a city in terms of addressing our issue of homelessness. But again, I'm bringing this back to SEPA and how it's been used. There was a crosscut article a year ago of the delays on the Mandatory Housing Affordability Act that the city passed. The delays caused a loss of about 717 units, and that was a conservative estimate. So we've seen where SEPA is used and the delays, it only compounds the issues that the city faces, and more importantly, not just the issues that the city faces, the struggle that families face in terms of having affordable housing in
Sure.
our city.
But you know, at the same time, council member, you know, I hear you on that. I think it's very, very valid. I think the argument is exceptionally valid. But at the same time, we're also seeing from the city moves that are just going through the motions, are reluctantly engaging with the community. When we're talking about tiny home villages, for example, it went up in Seattle's South Lake Union neighborhood. they made the decision before actually even talking with the community. They're supposed to talk with the community. They chose not to. It seems a lot of times that the city is taking positions that just want to get to their end point as quickly as humanly possible without talking to people. And I'm wondering if at the same time that you're pushing this idea, you can also help push the idea that maybe there should be better communication and buy-in from the communities before moving forward on some of these projects. Is that a fair request?
Well, I can only speak for myself.
Yes.
And definitely the points that I try to make through committee or through council. I myself have tried to both be as responsive as I can through and in this process of moving the CEPA legislation, of hearing community, engaging with community. I've had two hearings. I had a public hearing last night. We'll have another committee hearing tomorrow. And the comments that I've and the feedback that I've gotten has led to some amendments to the CEPA legislation. I mean, we're trying to make some additional improvements based on what I heard from residents in my district and from the Wallingford Community Council, who had made some recommendations about what the hearing examiner could do to, as well to improve that process as well. So I brought forth some from hearing and listening to community just what we can do to make the bill better. So I definitely have done my best to try to engage through the process with a variety of stakeholders, and such as even going, I mean, being on the radio with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I like the fact that you're open to talking with people who might disagree. There's a little bit of disagreement in this case, but I think mostly I'm on board with your reasoning behind it. I totally get it. I just want to make sure that it's fair for everybody. You're one of the few council members who actually is willing to have those conversations, and for that, I appreciate it, and I thank you, Council Member Pacheco. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. If you want to weigh in on this conversation, by the way, send me a text on the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline, 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. That was Council Member Abel Pacheco from right here in Seattle, who represents the district that we're in right now in Eastlake. Thank you so much for listening to The Jason Rand Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it. Councilmember Reagan Dunn, the Republican here in King County, he's proposing a $1 million program to give homeless people bus tickets to go back home, back to the communities that they came here from. And it is a great idea. It's not a new idea, to be clear. This is not a new idea. Cities already do this. Seattle does this. Other cities all around the country already do this. But it's an idea that I don't think we spend enough time talking about, because it interferes with this weird talking point that is factually inaccurate that comes from people like Seattle City Councilmember Lisa Herbel, that, you know what, virtually all the people here, they didn't come here from out of state or out of county. These are your neighbors who are homeless. That is not true. It is certainly true that we have neighbors that are homeless, people who live here. But it's also true that we've got a whole bunch of people who are coming into this area because they know that we have so many resources, subsidies to give them for free. And it is costing us an arm and a leg, making it so that it's nearly impossible to fundamentally get at the root cause with the money that we have, because we've got so many outsiders. And so Reagan Dunn on King 5 was saying, look, this is a plan that will be efficient in the use of tax dollars.
The initial ask of taxpayers is about $132 million. But we just have to remember, the city of Seattle has arguably the highest per capita homeless population anywhere in the United States. And so that doesn't happen by accident. That happens because we have failed policies that aren't working, or a constellation of policies that aren't working.
Now, why is this a good idea? Very simple. When you send people back to an area that they have contacts with, meaning they have friends and family members, a support system, guess what? It's in the name. What do you think the support system does, Producer Peyton?
Supports.
Say it with confidence.
Support.
Yeah, it supports them. When you've got people who care about you, who in some cases don't even know where you are, don't even realize these folks are homeless, once you put them back in that community, they start to take care of them and they get them back on a path to sustaining themselves. There are people who are here from all over the country, from all over the state. If we spend $100, $200, $300, $400 giving them a ticket to jump on that bus, go back to Topeka, go back to Houston, go back to Spokane, whatever it happens to be, they're going to be in a better position because they're going to get the help that they need, and we're going to be in a better position to not waste money on folks who can otherwise be treated very, very, very effectively.
Well, we need not only this sort of compassionate approach, which I think we're pretty good at in Seattle, but we need arguably some tough love things to happen as well. And so what I'm arguing that we do right now is roll out a series of reforms and proposals that will help. For example, way more treatment beds for addiction and recovery. One-third of our homeless population who die are dying from overdose. We need to do that. And when these minor petty offenses occur, we need to get them into treatment. Uncomfortable, but that happens all the time in courts all around the United States. We need to do more of that. We also know that a huge percentage of our homeless want to be reunified with their families in other parts of the country, but we can't do that. Cities like Berkeley and San Francisco have great programs that are one-way transportation programs for family reunification. We have nothing like that in Seattle. And for just a little amount of money, we can get folks home to where they need to be so they can get a roof over their heads and get through the challenging times in their lives that make them homeless.
Love this. There are so many things that are rather small, relatively small, that we can do right now that's going to have a really big impact. Now, we're getting some text messages on the None Better Tax Resolution hotline having to do with going after the drugs, dealing with that issue. We need to approach this also with law enforcement in mind. We have to be able to allow cops to do their jobs. We have to be able to let judges do their jobs. We have a prosecutor in Seattle with Pete Holmes, Seattle City Attorney. We have a prosecutor in King County with Dan Satterberg that refused to do their jobs. They do not want to put drug dealers in jail because they view them as people who need a little bit of extra help. And I very specifically say drug dealers. It's true, they also don't want to put drug users in jail ever, but they also don't want to go after drug dealers. And I can tell you they don't want to go after drug dealers because they have publicly promoted an idea that if you carry less than a certain amount of grams of drugs on you, regardless of whether we're talking about heroin or cocaine or meth or whatever, they're not going to prosecute you. Well, drug dealers hear that, and then drug dealers carry less on them. They'll keep a larger stash of drugs somewhere nearby. They'll only keep certain amounts on them. And so when they're popped, or if they end up getting popped by cops, they know that they're not going to do any meaningful time in prison. We have to change that. Satterberg doesn't want to change that. I'm working on a story right now specifically on a case that his office chose not to prosecute, and it would appear, based on the details I have right now, that they weighed the drugs, but because the cops didn't weigh the drugs without the packaging, they were like, oh, well, you know, we don't know what the drugs might have actually weighed without this packaging. We don't know what it actually would be, and so we're not going to go ahead and prosecute. That's wrong. That's not the right way to address this problem. We'll have more on that coming up. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really do appreciate it. Don't forget, give me a follow on Facebook, facebook.com/JasonRantsShow. Go there now, hit the follow button, go behind the scenes of the show. We'll be back doing this again tomorrow.